European Union has not treated us well.
Stupid European elites jumping off the cliffs once again.
Yes, you are the guilty people, and you refuse to accept it.
This is EU Scream, the podcast on Europe and its political extremes. I'm James, a journalist who's crisscrossed Europe for 15 years now, covering politics and the economy.
I'm Tom. I've been a lobbyist and spin doctor in Brussels for many years, and I've spent the last decade fighting climate change.
In this episode, the slick strategy used by the new generation of Europe's white supremacists. The executive director of the Counter-Extremism Project, David Ibsen, says a group in France is among those using a playbook borrowed from the U.S. First, we discuss Marine Le Pen's refusal to undergo a psychiatric test. If the leader of the French far right is a little crazy, then what kind of crazy is she? All right. So, Tom, do you think some of the behavior of far-right leaders could be linked to mental illness?
Right. So this is an interesting question. One's got to be a little bit careful around this. Mental illness clearly is a very large spectrum, and there is a vast amount of it in the population. What is clear is that young people, the rates of mental illness in youth are skyrocketing, certainly in the West. Now, let's just think about far-right leaders for a minute. They do display certain behaviours that would suggest some association with mental illness, one of the primary ones being paranoia.
Well, get this. Marine Le Pen, you know, the leader of the Rassemblement National, the new National Front.
Daughter of the much-storied Jean-Marie Le Pen. Yep.
Indeed, indeed. So Marine Le Pen's state of mind has been put in question. She's, in fact, been ordered to have a psychiatric examination by a French judge. And it's part of a case against her after she posted these super gory images of executions by the Islamic State to her Twitter account. Images that are in fact illegal in France, and that's why all of this has come about. So it turns out that she's refused to have this exam.
Je n'irai pas, bien entendu, me soumettre à cette expertise psychiatrique et j'attends de voir comment le magistrat.
In fact, this psychiatric test seems to be standard judicial procedure, a procedure that's designed to protect the defendant in such cases. Was she lucid and fully conscious when she posted this awful, awful stuff? A man being burned alive, someone being run over by a tank, and a beheaded American journalist. But her supporters say that the deep state is ganging up on her by reviving the old Soviet use of psychiatry to silence dissidents and political opponents. One supportive blogger is worried that Marine Le Pen is about to, quote, disappear into the bowels of a psych ward where release is not an option.
No.
How do you feel about that?
Right. I mean, like I said, right, the paranoia element of this, because they totally exist in France. Scattered across France, dark dungeons in which people with illnesses are chained up for decades. That's totally been happening. If you post a load of really mad stuff to your Twitter account, right, gory, horrible things. You know, what's the message she's trying to send there? She's trying to say, this is Islam. And it does show a contortion of their mental state, which cannot be healthy.
So I take a slightly different view on
that.
She just exploits these things. She's following the populist playbook. She's milking this for all it's worth by making herself seem to be the victim of these deep state opponents, right? So far right. Yet another tactic.
The response is clearly a tactic. But there's a more kind of fundamental, earnest question. You are asking for, in this case, the people of France to elect you as their representative and leader. Do they want reassurance that you are in a mentally fit state to do that? That does not seem unreasonable. Also, this issue with psychiatry, there's some really interesting history to this. Radovan Karadzic was a leading psychiatrist, the man behind the Greater Serbia and ethnic cleansing. Just saying, you know.
I mean, why can't we get Karadzic to examine
Le Pen?
I mean, that would just be the most ideal, you know, client-patient relationship I can think of.
People would pay to see that. There's also a very clear issue around mental illness in people who end up, again, kind of wrapped in these ideas and wrapped in this propaganda and wrapped in these narratives, find themselves in a very peculiar place.
It's rather wonderful if she is really if she is really agitated by this and thus actually paying a price for what is effectively Islamophobia.
Right.
And, you know, maybe she is genuinely embarrassed by having to go to undergo a test to assess her sanity, which I suppose would consist of questions like, you know, have you used drugs? Have you got obsessive ideas? Are you suffering from hallucinations? I mean, let's face it, her family does have some form on this.
A little.
Her anti-Semite father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was nearly 20 at the end of the Second World War, could only recall the Holocaust as a mere detail of history.
Yep. Et que je me suis borné à dire que les chambres à gaz étaient un détail de l'histoire de la guerre mondiale. Ce qui est une évidence.
So in a way, I think this court order is somehow more embarrassing for her than being stripped of her immunity by the European Parliament to allow the French to investigate her for fraud, which happened last year, and being refused loans by French banks, which has also happened to her.
But not by Russian banks.
Just
a note.
I also like this story because it dovetails nicely with the speculation that Donald Trump may have mental health challenges, ranging from narcissistic personality disorder to some form of dementia. And all of that kind of raises questions, you know, whether other members of the European far right, the Orbans, the Kaczynskis, even the entire illiberal international, you know, have bats in the belfry.
So there's an interesting point here, which is, because of course what they're not saying is Marine Le Pen's crazy.
No, they're just like, right. What was her state of mind when she sent out this stuff?
Right, exactly. And I think that's my point about the earnest question. The earnest question is, like, how are you? Are you okay? Like, what's going on in there? Because you spend, you know, a lot of time thinking some very weird thoughts about people. What they're saying at this point to Marine Le Pen is, so you can take that, the mental state of that individual, right, who has committed this incredibly terrifying act, and project that onto an entire religious group, and appear to think that's a normal thing to do. Because the level of political irresponsibility in that act does kind of raise a certain number of questions. So why would I give this person power when they can't even speak with responsibility, they can't even make mental associations with responsibility, and they're running for public office?
These are questions that are incredibly important, but I think we also have to be realistic about this and look at the way that a normal court order to undergo a psychiatric exam for tweeting out illegal material can be weaponized by the far right. And, you know, you think about when Trump has come under attack for maybe suffering from narcissism, dementia. Yep. And he countered all of this very, very effectively with more of that sarcasm, which is his trademark, saying that he's a stable genius.
Yeah.
And of course, that delighted the people who already support him. And just like Le Pen's attacks on the court and this judge, it's delighting her supporters. So, you know, as amusing as all of this may be, I think the real way to win against these people is not necessarily to discredit their sanity, but to really work hard to discredit their economic and political policies, which are often just as deranged.
So I think you're absolutely right. You've got to take them apart at that level. But what's also interesting about this response is, of course, it totally plays into the frame. So you're paranoid delusional. No, I'm not. The deep state's trying to destroy me with spiders. Right? Sounding a little paranoid delusional there. I'm a stable genius. Like, no, you're clearly really not very well. We'd like to take you into hospital and give you a test. Get away from me, the men in the white coats. It's like, could you just underline this for us a little bit more? You know, you're making it a little easy.
And people love it.
Right. Of course,
Tom,
people love it. People love it. But there's also this incredibly dark side to it, right? Think about the state of mind that these people are in when they're receiving these messages, right? These are clearly deeply troubled people. Yeah, you know, we've had the impact of this in the UK. We've seen this in the US most recently with the pipe bomber.
Yeah, what you're saying is that Marine Le Pen is fomenting violence.
Absolutely, because these messages that she's putting out there are getting into the heads of vulnerable people, you know, sat in their darkened rooms late at night reading all this mad, insane crap on Twitter and Facebook, but also the darker side of these message boards. And what are they doing? They're going out and committing acts of violence.
It's crazy on crazy.
It's crazy on crazy, absolutely. And it plays to the paranoia that is deep within that mental state. And it draws it to the surface and it turns it into acts of violence.
Marine Le Pen isn't really cuckoo. There's no sign she'll be certified for psychiatric care. That said, older far-right leaders like Le Pen do seem less calm and collected, less in control of themselves and their images than their successors. Look at Marion Maréchal Le Pen, the photogenic granddaughter of Jean-Marie and niece of Marine. She's a law graduate with professional poise, and she has showbiz sensibilities, appearing frequently in glossy magazines and building a big Instagram following. She's also even more right-wing and socially conservative than her aunt. Then there's the rise of youth identitarian groups in France. That's identitarian as in identity, white identity. Members of these groups have tidy haircuts, sharp clothes, winning smiles, and of course, highly polished social media operations. These identitarians are increasingly the focus of the Counter-Extremism Project, a nonprofit organization that was set up nearly 5 years ago to combat extremist ideologies like radical Islam. The project, based in New York and run by David Ibsen, now is devoting more of its attention to the dangers posed by white supremacism, including in Europe, and particularly in France. A branch of one of the groups David is watching took to patrolling the Alps this spring with helicopters and land cruisers. The group's stated goal was to stop Africans from reaching France, but the deployment seems mainly to have supplied snazzy, self-promoting video footage. The videos focus little, if at all, on the migrants who've already faced multiple traumas crossing to Europe, only to lose limbs from frostbite in the Alps, or on the young African man found dead near a ski resort in January. David was formerly a policy analyst at the U.S. State Department, and he also sees Europe as important for another reason, as an ally in diminishing hateful ideologies online. He's pushing hard for Brussels to enforce continent-wide rules, cracking down on social media companies like Facebook and Google that, as he sees it, shirk their responsibility for taking down content that foments hate. David spoke with me in a London hotel over the summer before he set off for a day of meetings with British lawmakers in Westminster. Those lawmakers were badly rattled by the murder in June 2016, days ahead of the vote for Brexit, of one of their number by a man who was a white nationalist. An alleged member of the band group National Action has admitted to plotting the assassination of a second member of parliament. David starts with an overview of white extremist groups in Europe and what they're learning from their American neo-Nazi counterparts.
There's some of the more established white supremacist far-right groups, Jobbik in Hungary, like the NPD in Germany. Of course, they have Golden Dawn in Greece. The one that we are watching the most now, and excuse my terrible French, is group Les Identitaires. And their offshoot Global Identity, which is actually kind of like their youth movement. And this is one of the groups that I think is kind of following the model of the newer groups in the U.S., whether it's League of the South or Identity Europa, who are taking this kind of more subtle approach to finding disaffected youth, appealing to them on the issues of culture and national pride, in opposition to the elites and PC, to kind of build a more robust, youthful base that resists criticism because on its face, it eschews violence. And even on its face, it eschews racism. But it's much more about this identity politics in this reference to cultural preservation.
So how long has this French group been around?
It was founded in 2003, so there are ties to older groups. But I think just the creation of the youth group in itself shows a focus on the new younger generation. I can't say to what extent they vote for Marie Le Pen in different elections. I can probably guess where their political alignments fall. But this kind of this creation of a separation from that kind of old far-right guard into this newer guard is a deliberate tactic that they pursue. And if you thought that there was no, and you assumed that there was no connection to any other far-right group, particularly ones from an older generation, you'd be pleased with that.
What are these new groups after? Do they want political power?
The stated goal, obviously, is exclusionary policies or politics. So you want to end Muslim migration in particular, and you want to preserve the European nativist character of the country, which is what the kind of their stated objective. But ultimately, yes, and I think this is why they're so careful to disavow violence and why they're so careful to describe themselves not as racist groups but as cultural preservation groups, is because they want to build the membership to ultimately have power. I mean, they've seen over the last 10 years, 15 years, how elections in Europe have gone. It's not out of bounds now to think that one of these groups could be, if not the ruling partner in some kind of parliamentary coalition, but at least be a parliamentary partner of some kind. If you have well-spoken, well-coiffed young men and young women who look, folks, I just want to preserve the France of my grandparents. You know, I'm just concerned about our history and our culture and the dilution of our national spirit. Bring us back again. That's an appealing message to a lot of people. And you work in a little bit of, you know, anti-Brussels rhetoric there. It's a compelling mix, I think.
Where do these groups get their money?
Everything from some of the groups in the U.S. sell merchandise on the website. Again, it goes back to this idea that people are not afraid or scared to be associated with some of these groups. They'll wear a t-shirt that says Identity Europa on it. Other is just regular kind of organizational fundraising type activities, which harkens back more to the older model, KKK, whatever it might be. You know, you might even have a cookout or some kind of gathering and everyone kind of funds it. Point being is that you don't really need that much funds, particularly this day and age, to really build a huge support group. Particularly if you're not looking to kind of have a network of individuals who are directing or being directed for attacks, or who are trying to inspire for attacks, which is a big difference between how the white supremacists utilize their network, which is mostly, again, to mainstream their ideology and to kind of build a support network, and how Islamic terrorists might be using these same tools to inspire people to commit attacks. And you got to make sure that they get weapons, and you have to tell them how to use a knife and how to build a bomb with acetone and all these different kinds of things. Some of the cases, the groups that we're talking about, is more aspirational in terms of building up a following for eventual political participation, not a same kind of like nihilistic view towards, you know, destruction of the other that you may find in the case of these Islamic terrorist groups. And that can govern their tactics a little bit.
Far-right populists have done well in recent European elections. Is that about white extremism too?
But I think with the recent elections and other decisions like Brexit, I mean, I think the possibility of having a more, on its face, populist makeup of the European Parliament, which could kind of provide a gateway for more far-right elements to follow in, is definitely a possibility. If no one asks you about your association with white supremacist groups, or no one really starts diving into, you know, well, what do you think about Mein Kampf? What do you really think about, you know, this immigration situation? And they just kind of put a camera in your face or a microphone in your face to have you talk about how, you know, you need more autonomy for your citizens, how Brussels is out of touch and technocratic. If you just talk about that, no one's really going to know. The candidates, because the people's attention is so divided by a million other things, and because the reporter's attention is divided by so many different things, you're not really getting the full in-depth exploration of what they really believe and what their connections might be. I mean, what do you do if a candidate runs for parliament? You do a cursory check online. You see if they have a Twitter account. They have a Twitter account. You scroll through it. Did they say anything about Mein Kampf? Oh, gotcha. But if they didn't, they're more shrewd than that. There's really nothing to really uncover. The danger is that you're going to have more of these far-right elements masquerading as populist, get into positions of power. And only after the fact that they get there do you start seeing the real consequences of that in terms of the racism and the xenophobia and the exclusionary politics.
There's a focus on technology at the Counter-Extremism Project. How does it work?
We're very fortunate to work with Dr. Hani Farid, who is head of the computer science department at Dartmouth College. in the U.S. And he developed something called photo-DNA about 10 years ago, which was hashing technology to identify known child pornography images. So hashing, basically what it is, it takes an image or a still frame from a video and extracts a set of numbers, basically an integer, that can then be used to identify the existence of that same image or video frame across a platform, right? And once you identify it, you can confirm that it's this banned content and you can have it removed. And it works very, very well. Error rate is very, very minuscule. So Dr. Fried and CEP thought that we could take that same technology model and apply it to the case of online terror content, online extremism. And so that's what we did. We call it eGlyph. We've tested it. It works. We've offered it to the tech companies for free, no charge. And we've been running various tests with it to kind of show its efficacy and how well it works. Again, it's really just reluctance on the part of the tech companies. I mean, the difference in the U.S. at least between, you know, the terror content that we're talking about and child exploitation material is that the latter is explicitly illegal. The terror content that we're talking about is not explicitly illegal yet in the U.S. So they feel that they're not compelled for a legal imperative to deploy this technology to remove it in the way they remove child pornography.
If technology is available to curb online extremism, what's Silicon Valley's excuse?
It's funny. I mean, we say that with the tech companies, when they don't want to remove something, they talk about freedom of speech and freedom of expression, right? When they do want to remove something, they talk about terms of service. Tech companies are very good at this. They conflate the Fourth Amendment and the First Amendment in the U.S. with, you know, free speech and protection from illegal search and seizure with this larger idea of free expression, which is much more vague and opaque. And they just talk, so they talk about it's free expression. People say, yeah, we have free expression. You can't deny us that. But if the tech companies are protectors of our fundamental rights or in some way, they are the greatest violators of our free speech, free expression, privacy rights on earth. Because they look at every single piece of content that we upload. They dissect it, analyze it, scan it, mainly so they can figure out how to sell for ads. They remove content all the time without explaining why. It's a canard to refer to free speech and free expression in this context. It really is about private companies doing what's in their interest. If they want to remove your content, if they want to suppress your post, if they want to decide not to give you an account, that's entirely 100% within their right.
Who's winning the wrestling match between the leaders of the technology companies like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook and legislators like those at the European Parliament?
You know, Zuckerberg testified for the U.S. Congress first, and I thought that went very poorly. And as badly as that went, I thought that the Brussels testimony went even worse, much worse. Really, there's kind of two main talking points they have. The one is, look, we take down 99% of all the terror content that we find. But when you really kind of look deeper into that, they're only talking about ISIS and Al-Qaeda content. Even if you do take the 99% figure at face value, it begs the question, you know, 99% of what? I mean, if it's 99% of a billion uploads, that 1% that's left out there is a tremendous amount of content, right? And then finally, I think as the public, in certain cases, we could expect to demand 100% action, right? If you're talking about child pornography, violent inciting extremist content, but if you're just focused on Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and it's all just talking about Islamist content, I think it's very problematic. What we have seen is in the UK Parliament, certain MPs have done a very good job of honing in on YouTube, Google execs in particular, on their failure to remove specifically prescribed terror content or extremist content, mainly from National Action, which is a prescribed UK terror group. And Yvette Cooper, who's the MP, has really kind of honed in on certain Google execs and asked repeatedly, you know, why have you not taken down this content? It violates your terms of service, and the group is banned under UK law. The UK is considering a new terror law that is very, very harsh penalties for people who download and stream terror content or outlawed content, which would include groups like National Action. Germany has a very, very stringent law that's now been put into effect called NetDZ, which has really serious penalties for companies that violate the statutes, upwards of fines of $50 million. The question is just, is this going to be done piecemeal, country by country? Or are we going to have something that kind of, like the new privacy law, that is promulgated from Brussels and kind of creates a level playing field for all Europeans? I don't know. But regulation is definitely going to happen. And I guarantee, looking back 10 years from now, we're going to look at the regulatory environment for internet companies and streaming companies and web hosting companies, and it's going to look a lot different.
Europe is tougher on hate speech than the U.S. So to what extent is the counter-extremism project pushing it an open door in Brussels?
That's why you've seen the lobbying teams and lobbying expenditures of Google, Facebook, Twitter really explode in the last 2 years, particularly in Brussels. Because they realize here that the First Amendment protections that we have in the U.S. don't apply, that there are things like hate speech laws in Europe. There are things that like illegal content, and when a German policymaker talks about illegal content, and they are describing a set number of images and phrases that you just cannot cite and you cannot spread. In that sense, it gives the European regulators much more power because they don't have to rely on just pleas to the companies to enforce terms of service. They can actually say, this content is illegal. If you don't take it down in an hour, you are going to be fined. If you don't take it down in 24 hours, you're going to be fined even more. In this debate, I am always siding with Brussels against my co-patriots in Silicon Valley. And it's nice, but a little unusual to be welcomed and received so warmly in Brussels whenever we come to give a briefing on the scourge of online extremism and why Silicon Valley has to do more.
That's EU Scream for this week. You can check our website at euscream.com for links discussed in the show and for more episodes. Please rate us on iTunes, tweet about us at EU Screams, and like us on Facebook. You'll also find us on Instagram and LinkedIn. EU Scream is edited and mixed by me, James Cantor. Tom Brooks and I produce the show. Laura Natale plays our piano. Thanks for listening.